Welcome to my platform, metro.co.uk's new podcast, where we speak to the authors of some of our first person and opinion section's most read articles of the past few years. My platform is all about drawing attention to underheard and underrepresented voices in the media, with guests talking about issues close to their heart. Hosted by me, Jess Austin. I edit the section of Metro that all of our lovely guests submitted their pieces to. As well as being among the most popular pieces, they're also some of my absolute favourites, and I can't wait to speak to the authors more about what inspired their pieces, unhindered by a pesky word count. In this series, we'll be having thought-provoking discussions about issues like the pension gap, pretty privilege, and the problematic side of fake tanning. We'll also be shining a light on people's lived experience, covering mental health, HIV diagnoses, and finding love after loss. This week, we're welcoming Gary Ratcliffe to the podcast. Gary is a CEO, educator, and disability rights campaigner, and dad to four incredible kids. Today, we're going to be discussing his story, which he shared with metro.co.uk in an article called "My Husband and I Adopted Four Kids, Three Have Disabilities. I Couldn't Be More Proud of Our Family." So we've had the pleasure of speaking before a few times. For our listeners who haven't got to know you, can you tell me a bit about yourself and your family?
Yeah, of course. It's my favourite subject at the moment, actually. So I'm Gary. I'm in mourning at the moment because in 2 weeks' time, I'm going to be 50 years old, which is a celebration for many, but not for me. I'm married to Kyle, and Kyle is a mid-40s man, and we've been together for 17 years. He says three of them happy. I'm sure it's actually 17 happy years. We are really privileged that we have four amazing children that we adopted over the last few years. We've got Hayden, who is 19 now. He's a big boy. He came to us when he was 6 years old. We have Curly, or Curtis, who's 12. And Curtis has a range of special needs and issues and challenges, but he lights up every room that he walks into. And then we have Bella and we have Phoebe, that are our two girls who joined the family a bit later on than the boys. And they're now 16 and 11. And they're biological sisters that we adopted together. Bella has Down syndrome. And Phoebe is a mainstream, bright and bubbly, but very naughty 11-year-old.
And so let's just start with your love story then. When did you meet Kyle, and was it love at first sight?
Oh, goodness me. It's going back a few years now. And at the time, I was teaching in Tokyo. So I'm a teacher by trade. You introduced me as the CEO, and I still find that title really difficult to handle because I'm a teacher and a head teacher. But now I run a group of nine schools. And at the time I was teaching in Tokyo, and I'd come back for a holiday. It was one, I think, wet and windy Saturday. And I'd gone into Canterbury, which was one of our local cities, to go and do some shopping. And I was standing in the queue of a very popular coffee shop. And if you can remember, you know, if you can visualize the steamed up windows and the queue going out the door, and everyone was a bit grumpy. And there was this guy who was standing behind me in the queue, and he just started talking to me. And whilst I might come across as quite confident on the podcast and telling the story, I'm quite shy. And he started talking to me, and he said, "Oh, you know, I think they might be growing the coffee beans as well as making the coffee," and ha ha ha, and had a little joke with me. And I sort of looked at him and smiled and nodded and didn't think anything of it, and grabbed my coffee and went to sit down at a table. And 2 minutes later, he came over to me and said, "Do you mind if I sit with you?" Well, my instinct was to say, "No, go and find your own table," actually. But I said, "Yep, please take a seat." And we started talking, and through a cappuccino, oat milk, extra shot, by the way, I arranged to keep in touch with Kyle. Several months went past, actually. And then one day he suddenly got in contact and said, "I'm thinking of booking tickets to come and see you in Tokyo. Is there a space on your floor?" And I thought, "Oh, well, you're a bit late, actually, because I'm back in the UK now. I'd finished my posting in Tokyo, and I was back in the UK." So we arranged to meet for a drink, and we met for the drink, and the rest is history, really. After that first night, I don't think we were apart for several years, actually. in terms of actually being away from each other for an extended period of time. But I've got to tell you, Jess, that that first date nearly didn't happen because I am very, very punctual. I like being early, right? I'm that guy that, you know, when they're going on a holiday to the airport, thinks they're running late if they don't arrive before 4 hours before the flight, right? You know, and I like getting to the boarding gate and I'm checking the screen, where Kyle is exactly the opposite. And 2 hours before the flight will be asking me where his passport is, right? So I was waiting for him that first date, and we'd arranged to meet in Rochester, which is a beautiful town in Kent, in Medway. He was 15 minutes late. So I just sent him a little text message to say, where are you? And he said, oh, I'm really sorry, I'm just parking the car. Another 10 or 15 minutes went by and he came running up the street, a bit hot and a bit flustered. And he said, oh, I'm really sorry. You know, parking's terrible in Rochester. And if he'd been 2 minutes longer, I'd have gone and the love story would never have happened. But it was years later when he told me that actually when I called him to say, where are you? He was just leaving the house. He wasn't parking the car at all. And I should have been warned and I should have known what was to come because nothing's ever changed in our relationship, I've got to say.
So apart from timekeeping issues, what has your relationship as a couple been like since then? Were you pretty set straight away on having kids?
Yeah, I think for a gay couple, there are different paths, different routes you can go down. You know, you could have the sort of city life with cream carpets and beautiful glassware and expensive art on the walls, maybe. Or you could choose to have a family life with dogs in the background. I don't know if you can see the very naughty dogs that are wandering around. And we're both really family people. So we made it known to ourselves quite early that we wanted a family, but we just didn't know at that point how we were going to go about that and how that was going to happen for us as a couple.
You mentioned feeling conflicted when you had friends offer surrogacy to you as well.
Yeah, I think that was a really interesting time in our life, actually, because there is a well-meaningness amongst friends that want to offer their womb to you so that you can fulfill your dream of having a child. And we thought long and hard about that. And we were so grateful to those people that came forward and offered to support us in that. It was nothing that we had thought about in terms of maybe a more professional or formal arrangement with anybody. But we had thought long and hard about those offers that come from friends. But we wanted to be really clear that these were going to be our children in our family. Kyle worked in social care as well as in higher education. And I worked in schools, as you know. And we just saw a lot of children around us that needed extra support and, you know, had a really bad start in life. And we felt it would be the right thing for us to do to offer ourselves first as foster carers and maybe look at adoption moving forward. So we reached out to Kent County Council to see if we would be eligible to be foster carers.
And what was it like when they said yes? Were you just overjoyed to be taking that next step?
Well, it was a bit bizarre, really, because again, happened by accident. It was a moment of chance. So I'd taken a day off work for some reason. I don't know why, because I never take a day off work. And I'd gone down to the beach in Deal and I bought a newspaper. And I never buy a newspaper because I read everything online. And it was, I think, the Dover Express, which was the local paper at the time. And there was an advert in the paper. And it was little boy wants a family. And it was Hayden. And he'd, the councillor had put an advert in the paper to see if it was possible to find him his forever family. And we found out later on that was probably his last chance because he'd been in care a while. He was 6 years old. He was at the optimum time for adoption. And if it had been left much later at that time, you know, his chances were slipping away. Hayden also had cerebral palsy and was a full-time wheelchair user. So trying to find a family that was right for him was a real challenge for the council. So when we put ourselves forward, and it was me just making a phone call, answering the ad, they were really keen to meet us. And I think it was within a week that the lovely Gwen, who was our social worker, turned up to our house in Deal on her little, on her bike, her push bike, with the basket at the front. And she whizzed down our road and parked outside. And she came in and she was just full of joy and love and support from day one. And we knew that, A, she was going to be a brilliant social worker for us. But I think we knew from that first day that there was a good chance we were going to get Hayden.
And I love the fact that you got in touch with him before you spoke to Kyle about this. Did you just know that he would be fully supported, but supportive?
I wasn't going to mention that bit, but yeah, I was so compelled by this picture I had in my head of Hayden, this little boy who had this image of the family he wanted. And whilst our family was never going to match his expectations, because he wanted a mum and a dad, a mum who cooked good roast dinners, and had a car, and you know, all very specific. He was very specific in his requirements. I just knew that it was the next step for us. So I contacted the adoption line or the fostering line, whatever it was at the time, had a brilliant conversation with them, and then phoned Kyle. And I think that's been a real sort of marker of our relationship, in that we're really supportive of each other. We're rarely in conflict. We don't row, but we're quite intuitive about what the other one wants and what the other one is going to say or think. And I knew he would be absolutely fine. And he was, of course.
And had you considered fostering a child with disabilities before you saw Hayden's advert?
No, it wasn't something that was the top of our list. It was a hard decision to make to move forward once we knew the range of needs that Hayden had. Hayden has cerebral palsy, which affects all four limbs. He uses a wheelchair all of the time. At the time we met him, which was when he was 6 years old, his speech was really difficult to understand. He didn't eat particularly well and had a tube in his tummy so that he could be fed. So he had a range of really quite complex needs. He was on 6 or 7 different medications every day. And to take on a child like that when you're inexperienced as parents is a really big decision to make. And I think the only reason we move forward with it is because we both had experience in our professional lives of working with children with disabilities. Kyle more so than me. I mean, I'd been a teacher and a head teacher for many years, but the range of needs that Hayden has, I'd never dealt with on a personal level. Just changing the pad of a child who is doubly incontinent, you know, it takes a skill, and it's a skill I had to learn. And I learned it by, you know, Hayden leaking regularly onto his trousers or into his wheelchair, and me having to, you know, change Hayden and clear that up. And that's the reality of caring for and loving a child with a disability, are all those things that you have to go through, as well as just loving the child. You know, there's lots to it. And we've become experts in that, but we wouldn't change a thing, actually. And so the whole question around disability hadn't come up until we'd met Hayden. And even when we'd started the process and we'd gone through, you know, lots of tests and questions. And, you know, if you think the questions on this podcast, Jess, are taxing, they're nothing compared to the questions you get from social services when you're looking to foster or adopt. And that's quite right, because they need to make sure they're getting the right people. But we took a walk from Deal, which was on the Kent South Coast, right the way through to the next town, to Sandwich, just talking through whether we felt we were up for it, whether we were up for it in terms of the impact it was going to have on our lives, but equally whether we were capable and whether we would do Hayden justice. Because for a child in care, they've already been through trauma, and we would never have wanted to put Hayden through that again, you know, saying yes and then realizing it was way beyond our control or our capabilities. We thought we could do it. So we move forward with Hayden.
And what was it like meeting him for the first time once, you know, you decided to go ahead with the fostering?
Hayden still has a photo in his room of our first meet. I'm much younger. not as handsome as I am now, of course. But you can see the excitement on all of our faces. He's in his wheelchair and we're sitting on a couch in the foster carer's home that Hayden was at that particular time. And we're sort of leaning into each other. I was leaning in because I was really struggling to understand what Hayden was saying, because he was really difficult to understand. But you could see the hope and the excitement on Hayden's face that maybe he might be going home with these two strange men and making a family. And that first meeting should have told us everything we needed to know, really, about what Hayden was going to be like and his character and his way of charming every single person he meets has never changed. It's just developed and got more sophisticated as the years have gone on. And you know, this biggest, brightest smile. Oh, he's a complete nerd who loves computers, loves technology, thinks he should be on X Factor because he's got the best singing voice, where in actual fact he can't sing a note, but has such pure joy of listening and taking part in music. He's a good big brother to the other three and is really caring, actually. Not afraid to express an opinion or two. And I think I'm really proud that we've taught him that. I think he's learned from us in that, you know, he's a child that was in care. So he's a previously looked after child. That's the sort of designation now. And he has a disability and he lives with two gay dads. And so there's lots of potential there for him to be bullied or to be singled out as different. And he just won't allow that. You know, he won't sit down and be the victim. He's a lover of life. And I'm recording this podcast at home at the moment and he's out somewhere. I've no idea where he is, but he's with a personal assistant in his van. He's gone off to enjoy life somewhere, who knows where.
And when did you make the move to adopt him? When did you know it was like, obviously, that was the next step?
Well, that's quite complicated because you've got to go back 13 years. And that's when we first met Hayden for fostering. And there was always the sort of intention that fostering would turn into adoption. But you've got to remember, 13 years ago, opinions and attitudes were not as liberal as they are today. And two gay men fostering a disabled child had all sorts of challenges and issues. And I believe we were the first gay male couple to foster within Kent County Council. There'd been gay female couples, but not male couples. And so we had a lot of barriers to overcome before we were accepted, really. And it wasn't just the case of following a simple fostering to adoption route. We had to prove ourselves as parents. And I think probably having to prove ourselves more than a heterosexual couple would have to prove ourselves. And I have absolutely no problem with foster carers and prospective adoptees being held to higher standards, because I think these children and young people deserve the very best parenting they can. But it wasn't the easiest task. And before we decided to adopt, Curtis came along, who was our second little boy. Curtis, or Curly as we call him now, he was only 12 weeks old when he came to us. And he came to us because the foster carers that he was with needed a break. They were shattered. They were exhausted. Curly is a really complex little boy. He had trauma at birth. And he has never recovered from that, in that he has severe, profound, and multiple disabilities, including cerebral palsy and epilepsy and global delay and being blind. He's also fed by a tube in his tummy, so he's nil by mouth. He's doubly incontinent, and he didn't have much going for him when he was 12 weeks old. He stopped breathing regularly, and we took Curtis in for a weekend, and he never left. And we were told to probably not get too attached to Curtis because he probably wouldn't make his first birthday. He was a very poorly little boy. And I guess that's where the Ratcliffe mentality kicked in for me and Kyle, in that we would not allow Hayden to be adopted without Curtis to also be adopted? Why should Hayden be part of our family and Curtis not? Even though people were writing him off and saying that, you know, what was the point really? Because he didn't know any better and he wasn't going to live long anyway. Well, I felt that Curtis is, you know, deserved to be part of a family in exactly the same way as Hayden did. So we had a bit of a standoff with the council, and we moved forward with adoption for both boys, which happened, I think, about 11 years ago now. And they were adopted within the week of each other, and became little and big brother pretty soon after each other. Imagine being on a national game show where, you know, the prize is unlimited and it's down to one final question or one final vote from the public. And that's what it's like adopting a child, because you get to know the child, you form relationships with them, you put all sorts of plans into place. And then you have to go to a panel, and that panel make the final decision to say yes or no. And then you go to court, and a judge makes the final decision to say yes or no. And you hope that the parents that you've had a really good relationship with moving forward into adoption, you hope they're not going to turn around and contest the adoption. And then you're going to hope that all of those things fall into place at the same time. And when they do, it's a massive relief and a chance for celebration. But you're never quite sure until you've got that piece of paper in your hand to say that they're part of your family. And, you know, they don't belong to us. They are part of our family and a really important part of our family. But for any adoptee who goes through that process, who forms those most strongest bonds with a child, it's not always a dead cert until the piece of paper is in your hand. But we were just full of joy and hope for the future and excitement for us as a family that, you know, we were two gay dads with really good jobs and, you know, we were successful in our professional lives. And then suddenly we'd adopted these two boys. And what was the future going to hold? Because now we were registered parents as well, with their names being changed to ours. And that's a really important thing not to take for granted. And I'm just so proud of our country and the laws and the legislation that it's put through to enable us as, you know, two really loving people to be able to give a home to our two boys.
And can you tell me a bit about Curly?
He's now 12. He's a big lump. He's got the most curly hair, hence his name Curly. He's had a really tough life, but interspersed amongst that toughness and that challenge is absolute joy and a zest for life. He's currently in his bedroom, I think, had trouble at birth, which meant he was born with disabilities that he didn't have until he was born. And I think myself and Kyle both went through quite a phase of mourning for the child that Curly could have been. But an absolute celebration of the child he is, because he can't talk and he doesn't move very much apart from his head a little bit. But he has such a big impact on our family. He is absolutely loved by every single member of the family. When he's not here because of being in hospital or, you know, being poorly, then he leaves a massive gap. And for a child that was, you know, was not meant to reach his first birthday, to be 12 years on and to having faced a number of really tough times, you know, wow, he's a fighter and he is one strong little boy. And he's at the center of everything we do, actually.
We'll talk about Curly's farm in a bit as well. But, you know, it must have been quite hard for you and Kyle at the point of adoption when you have doctors saying he might not make it to a year to take on that anticipatory grief as well, with the fact that you are going to, that you, there's a chance that you could lose your child.
I think we took it as a challenge, actually. we'll get him to two. And when he got to two, we'll get him to four or five. And we'll get him to start school. And he went to school And he had an ambulance taking him to school every day with two trained paramedics in the back of the ambulance taking him to school every day because he deserved that opportunity to be like every other child and go to school. But of course, there was trepidation and of course, there was a sense of what are we letting ourselves in for here? Because no one was holding a gun to our head to say that we had to adopt Curtis. It was our choice. And it was a big decision to make, but it was a really easy decision. Because once you've fostered Curtis and you've got to know him, why does he deserve any less of an opportunity than Hayden or any other child? But that doesn't mean there haven't been some really tough moments in Curtis's life. So even just last summer, he was in hospital for about 3 months on and off. He got a chest infection that went to pneumonia. And we were asked to say goodbye to Curtis, I think, 3 times within about a week. And then all of a sudden, we noticed he'd been given a different antibiotic. And within 3 days, he was fighting fit and out of hospital again. And that happens quite a lot. So to experience that as a family, to try and support your other children through that whilst supporting each other as a couple is really tough. But we chose that. We chose that for ourselves and we chose that for Curtis and we chose that for our other kids. And they have only benefited from that, right? They've only benefited from Curly in our lives. But the support I would always want to give is to the single mum on a fourth floor flat that is still doing her best with a child like Curtis, but hasn't had the choice because actually it's their biological child and, you know, she loves them with all her heart and she hasn't got the privilege or the opportunity or the choice that we had because we did. We had a choice. We could have said, it's been really nice knowing you, Curly, but now you need to go somewhere else. And that's the privilege of being a foster carer or a prospective adoptee that you can opt out. And for many families with disabled children, they can't and they wouldn't want to opt out. So it's always quite difficult for me to get a sense of people thinking we're doing a great job with Curtis when actually we chose that. So it's up to us. For other families, they haven't had the choice.
And so can you tell me a bit about Phoebe and Bella?
Well, that took our life in a completely different direction because I said a bit earlier that we were the first gay male foster carers in Kent. And as part of that registration process, and I can't believe this is the case now because I don't think this still happens, but I'm not sure, we were only registered to look after boys. So as a gay male couple, we couldn't look after girls. And when we had Curtis and Hayden, we were still registered as foster carers. And we'd been contacted by the council to see if we could look after two older boys. I think they were 11 and 13. So we made all the preparations to have these two boys come to our house. And at the very last minute, the plans were cancelled because something had gone wrong in court or they'd found an alternative family. And so the two boys didn't turn up. But instead, what turned up at our door were Bella and Phoebe, a six-year-old and an 18-month-old that didn't know what the hell was going on in their life, that had been taken directly from court to this house with these two men that they'd never met. Complete trauma. And we were the stopgap before a plan was put in place for them. It was probably one of the most traumatic days, not only of their life, but of our lives as well. The kids were in a terrible state. They were dazed. They were confused. We'd set up our spare bedroom for two boys and these two girls came. We didn't have a cot. We didn't have a high chair. We had no baby food. We had no toys for a six-year-old girl with Down syndrome. They had no clothes with them. And we had to start that night. You know, I remember being in the big supermarket locally to us at midnight, buying everything they had just to try and get us through the next day. And they were only meant to be with us for a very, very short period of time. But they were thriving with us. We got them into routines, you know, bedtime routines. We got them into eating. We got them into school. Bella's attendance at school had suddenly gone to 100%. Phoebe went to nursery. They were starting to socialize with other people. It was brilliant to see the potential that both girls had. And then we found out they were going to be put up for adoption. So we took part in the writing of all the papers that go with the adoption process. And we suddenly realized, there was the potential for them to be split up for adoption. You know, Bella has Down syndrome. She's not the easiest child because of her learning needs. Phoebe at the time was very bright, very bubbly, very beautiful and completely mainstream. And it was felt they had the best chance of life for both of them to be split up. And we just could not allow that to happen. Oh, dear me. Looking back on that time now was quite frustrating because we were told that we probably wouldn't be eligible to adopt the girls because we had enough on. And, you know, how on earth would we cope with four children? Regardless of the fact we'd had them for 6 months by now and, you know, we'd done everything we possibly could for them and they were thriving. There was real questions that I still think was because of our sexuality and the fact that we were a male couple. And we had to jump through even more hoops and even more tests and challenges. You know, it was a really frustrating time. It was really tough. We thought we got approval from our foster carer to move forward with the adoption. And then we had to have an independent foster carer just in case, you know, there were things that weren't being picked up. And we had this lovely social worker come to our house and do this independent assessment of us. And at the end, he said, I'm going to have to come back. And I said, why on earth are you going to have to come back again? And he said, because it's just too calm. I was like, what do you mean it's too calm? Well, I haven't seen you deal with, you know, trauma and, you know, different challenges. And I said, well, this is what it's like in our house. It is calm because our kids are brilliant. And so we had to really put our foot down and say, no, you know, we're moving forward with this because you haven't given us any reasons not to. So we did. And the most bizarre thing was, and I'll never forget this, Bella and Phoebe's parents, who were their biological parents, they wrote to the judge at the time of the adoption and said that they would agree with the adoption, but only if it was me and Kyle adopting them, which was a very bizarre thing to happen. But it gave us a really good starting point for them knowing their girls were going to be looked after okay. And we've told the girls that on numerous occasions when they ask about their birth family and you know, how that affects them. And you know, their parents just wanted the best for them, actually. And I'm glad that we've been able to be those people that can give the best to our girls.
And they've been with you since 2014 now. What are Bella and Phoebe like as they've grown up?
Bella is a diva who loves a handbag and, you know, if it's got a bit of an animal print on her shawl or on her t-shirt, then she's really happy. She has significant learning needs, but she loves school. She jumps out of bed, gets herself dressed. And we've seen real progress with Bella, actually. So Bella's now 16. She loves all the things that 16-year-olds like. You know, she's a Strictly fan on a Saturday night, and when Strictly's not on, she'll watch the reruns. She loves her iPad. She loves dressing up, loves a good long bath as well. Certainly over the last year, you know, she's learned to dress herself. She's learned to be more independent. She's so polite. For someone with such high needs, I would take her anywhere in terms of the poshest restaurant. When we first started looking after Bella, we took her to Pizza Hut one day. We only realized as we left the restaurant that the piece of pizza that she was eating at the time of leaving, she deposited in somebody's handbag on the way out of the restaurant. We don't get that sort of behavior anymore. Phoebe is by far toughest of our four children to parent, because she has a very strong will. She likes lots of things, but can't concentrate on anything for more than 5 minutes. She's very bright. She's going to grammar school in September, but told me she was thinking of not going to grammar school because she didn't know whether she could deal with the girl drama, which was a nice phrase that I hadn't heard before. She's got a wide range of interests and passions. She loves horse riding, but she equally loves makeup and dressing up. Best thing about Phoebe is that she understands her place in the family, and that she is the little sister, but with the biggest responsibilities. And we are really careful not to make her the young carer, you know, the one with all the jobs, but she takes that on herself. And she's always really, really protective over her big sister, but equally as loving with Curly. And typical brother and sister relationship with Hayden, where they don't stop bickering from waking up until they go to sleep. But I've got a lovely photo of Phoebe talking to Curly. Curly's in his easy chair in the living room, and Phoebe's just leaning over and holding his hand. She didn't know anyone was watching or taking a photo. And it's just pure, genuine love for a sibling. And so when she's being particularly cheeky or disruptive, or she's telling me what she is or isn't going to do, or whether she's asking me for another 20 quid for this or that, I just remember that photo, because that sort of forgives everything, really.
And that photo, I suppose, sums up a lot about your piece, is just the pride you feel in your family, the pride that you and Kyle feel in your family.
I think the pride comes because each of them have had particular challenges that they've had to overcome, and they've done it with good grace and with positivity, and they've not only become better people themselves, but have educated others as well. So Phoebe has faced a little bit of homophobic bullying at school. Not much, but enough for us to be phoned and to be told about it. And her response was, "It's fine, Dad. You know, I just had to put him straight. You know, I'm glad that we've sort of built that resilience with our kids." They take the mickey out of each other a lot. You know, dinner time is quite robust in our house. Not always the most politically correct. Hayden and Phoebe have particular names for me and Kyle. Phoebe will, without being unkind, but still in a sibling way, talk about Hayden's disabilities. Hayden will talk about Phoebe's, her intelligence without having any common sense at all. And I think with, and you'll also get Bella going, "Yeah, Hayden," you know, when, so Phoebe will be abusing Hayden and Bella will then chip in. So because they've got that relationship at home that is really robust, but loving and supportive, they can pretty much deal with anything in their lives when we're not there. And I think that's the pride I've got, that they are really loving kids that I'm so proud of. But they've also started to show us that they're going to be good people in future life too.
Amazing. Can you tell me a bit about Curly's farm as well?
In 2016, we were really, really lucky to take part in a BBC TV program, DIY SOS. I don't know if you've heard of it or if you've seen our program. But Nick Knowles came along with his team and basically knocked our house down and rebuilt it in 9 days. How bizarre is that? I still can't believe it happened, but we were nominated for it. We went through a massive selection process. We pulled out twice. We didn't feel as if we were worthy of this being done for us. Wrestled with the fact that there were families like the mum I talked to you about earlier, who had no choice in being in the situation she was in. We felt there were people much more worthy of the attention of the BBC than us. But they kept pushing forward and they kept persuading us that actually, no, this was not about being the most worthy, because there will always be someone more worthy than the person they've chosen. But it was about the story that we could tell. Genuinely, any sense of overstatement we were blown away by the support from our community and our family and friends. And they had, I think, 300 people come to work on our house from a community. We live in a community that hasn't got the best reputation. There are, I think, 3 prisons on the Isle of Sheppey, but there are 30,000 people absolutely full of love and community spirit and support. When we had our house rebuilt, we were just blown away by that generosity, but still felt a massive sense of guilt. Right, we were humbled, but at the same time, we were guilty that gift that had been given to us hadn't been given to somebody else more worthy. So we decided, as payback to the community, to start a charity, and we started a charity in our back garden called Curly's Legacy. And Curly's Legacy, named after our son Curly, because he's not going to be around forever, in terms of, you know, he has a limited life expectancy. No matter what that's going to be, we wanted him to have a legacy for his name to be remembered. And we wanted to tie that into thanking the community for all the work they'd done in our house. So from the establishment of the charity, we started 2 projects. One is Curly's Caravan. So we fundraised and we got enough money to buy a caravan on the local caravan holiday park. And we give out free holidays to disadvantaged families now, and those families that need a break, and those families that want to make memories in a seaside location. So picture me, right? CEO of a multi-academy trust of 9 schools. I'm very important. I'm there on a Friday night, sometimes cleaning that caravan when there's no one else to do it. I try not to do it every time, but that's what I do. And Kyle started Curly's Farm. And Curly's Farm is for those children who have a disability or a special need, or who are in care and in their 5th family, or those that have been excluded from school, or those with no place in the world, or those with no friends, or who are isolated, or those with poor mental health, from 3 years old right up to, you know, 25 for children and young people, and further for the adults that we work with. Kyle works with them on Curly's Farm to develop their resilience and their team building and their communication and their respect for each other, as well as for themselves, and respect for the animals that they care for. Curly's Farm started with 1 little boy in our back garden, and now serves over 300 children a week on a 10-acre site, plus our back garden, plus a 3rd site with 5 acres, plus over 20 staff who have all experienced some form of care in their life, or having a child with a disability, or have real experience of working with children with particular challenges. And who could have thought 5 years ago when we started this that it would become the success it is today? And he's not here, so I don't really have to say this, but it's because of the absolute determination, hard work, long hours of Kyle to make Curly's name live for a long time, but also to give something to those children that are not given a chance elsewhere. And there are some really amazing success stories of those children that have come to the farm, who have found their place, who have experienced something they've never experienced before. That's down to Curly's Legacy.
Amazing. And so, you know, you're heaping praise on Kyle as well, but, you know, and you've been through lots of challenges, but it seems like you just handle things, as you said, you're very intuitive with each other and you handle things in the best way. And do you think it's just made your relationship even stronger, and your family is so strong because you and Kyle are so strong together as well?
Yeah, I think there's some tips and hints and piece of advice for any family. One is honesty and communication. So Kyle regularly tells me, or reminds me, he's not my PA, because I have a PA at work, and I tend to think that that goes into the house as well sometimes. I tell him regularly that he can't take on another project because he's got 17 projects running at once, and the 18th might just tip us over the edge. But it's also about realizing that taking risks are good. It's good to take risks if they're calculated, and that if you think something's not right, to stand up and fight for that. Also, not to take yourself so seriously. You know, we we have a beautiful house, we have an amazing family, but we have the most ridiculous dog. I mean, you know, the dogs rule this house, not the children. We often find ourselves in predicaments where we get ourselves into situations that we want our kids to have the best experiences. And then, you know, I mean, planning a trip, just, you know, most people with disabled children will find it a challenge to plan a trip to take their children out, to take them away on holiday. We got all of our kids, all four of them, on a train to Amsterdam a couple of years ago, just before lockdown. And they just had the best holiday ever, you know. So taking risks is really important to us as a family. But I think, you know, for us, it's about the respect we have for each other and just realizing that we've got massive flaws. Those flaws are fine, you know. So going back to what I said at the very beginning about Kyle's timekeeping, he is never, ever going to change. And my obsession with time is also never going to change. And that's absolutely fine. I think he was only on time for our wedding because we were actually together. I mean, you know, there was no way I was going to let him sleep somewhere else because he would have been late. Let's face it.
Kind of my last question is, when you think of your family now, kind of what's the overwhelming emotion that comes to you?
I think it still has to be pride, doesn't it? Because we love our kids so much. Of course we do. There is no difference in the love I feel for any of my children because they're adopted than if they were a biological child. So love is given for us. And with that love is, you know, comes the honesty and the respect and the fun and the stupidity. But I'm incredibly proud of them, each in very different ways. Curly's resilience, his fighting spirit in terms of bouncing back from every illness that he has. Hayden, his sense of humor and his nerdiness and his absolute belief he's going to have a number one single by the end of next year, which he's really not. Bella for being absolutely sassy and walking with a swagger, but always with a handbag in hand. And Phoebe for being that well-rounded girl who can see the absolute beauty in having three very special siblings that cause her some troubles, but actually it's made her the person she is today, which is just a really beautiful and kind little girl. So I'm really proud of them all.
Thanks for listening to my platform and to Gary's experience. You can find Gary on social media under @GaryRat, and you can find out more about Curly's Farm at curliesfarm.co.uk. Please leave us a rating and a review. It really helps people to find the podcast. Our main aim with this podcast is to give a platform to underheard voices, offering human-first stories. We'd love to hear if Gary's story helped shape your worldview. If so, please let us know on Twitter at @MetroOpinion or by email at platform@metro.co.uk. My platform is produced by Pineapple Audio Production. I'm Jess Austin. Thanks for listening.